Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 50 years ago this spring, the Food and Drug Administration gave a green light to the pill, the birth control pill, for use by American women. Suddenly, the world was a different place for married and unmarried women and men. One little pill and a world of change. This hour on Point, the birth control pill at 50 and what it has meant for women, sex, and society. You can join the conversation. How would you describe the impact of the pill? Have you ever known a world without it? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. With me today from New York is Nancy Gibbs, editor-at-large for Time Magazine. She's author of this week's big cover story, Love, Sex, Freedom, and the Paradox of the Pill. Nancy Gibbs, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
What's the paradox, madam?
Well, the paradox is one I discovered as I started doing this research, which was that so much of what I thought I knew about the pill turned out to be wrong. And that got me curious. And the more I talked to people, both who were, women who were in college in the 1960s or went back and read what was being written at the time and has been written since, I realized there are a lot of misconceptions about the impact that it did have and the impact that it did not have.
In a way, maybe the biggest one, and you go right to it, is the sexual revolution. A lot of people have hung that on the pill. Say the pill came and the sexual revolution came. You say the equation's not that simple.
Well, it's sort of a classic logical fallacy that when two things arrive at the same time, one is assumed to have caused the other. So the pill was approved in May of 1960. And the next thing you know, you have Sex and the Single Girl and the Summer of Love and Woodstock and this great change in sexual behavior. And so even at the time, there were any number of articles being written that attributed all of this new sexual license to the arrival of the pill, all of which ignored the fact that at least first decade, the pill was prescribed for birth control almost exclusively to married women.
By law,
even
in many states.
Planned Parenthood clinics would not give it to single women.
And by law in many states. I mean, you just didn't have access. It was out there. Everybody was talking about it, but not everybody could get it, I guess.
That's right. And it took, you know, in some cases, it took a little ingenuity. You know, it was not unheard of for a girl to borrow an engagement ring from a friend and present herself at the doctor's office and say, I'm about to get married. It wasn't as though doctors demanded to see a marriage certificate, but it was much more difficult for unmarried women to get it. And so the notion that somehow it was the arrival of the pill that unleashed this wave of sexual license just doesn't hold up historically.
And yet people, humans, men, women had grappled with fertility and pregnancy and timing and sex for a long, long time. This came into a whole social picture and in some ways did change it. We'll talk about those. Here's a little recreation. Nancy, this is from Mad Men, and it may give a flavor. I'm curious what you think about it. But this is presented, this is episode one, season one, years 1960, and it's presented as an example of what it took for a woman to kind of step forward and say, yes, please, to the pill. Here, the character Peggy, demure young secretary, visits a gynecologist to get a prescription for birth control pills.
I see from your chart and your finger that you're not married.
That's right.
And yet you're interested in the contraceptive pills.
Well,
no reason to be nervous. Joan sent you to me because I'm not here to judge you. There's nothing wrong with a woman being practical about the possibility of sexual activity. Spread your knees.
That's good to hear.
Although, as a doctor, one would like to think that putting a woman in this situation is not going to turn her into some kind of strumpet. Slide your fanny towards me. I'm not going to bite.
A strumpet? What was the reception, Nancy, at the time to this medical breakthrough?
Well, one thing that I was struck by is that the pill was actually approved for the treatment of menstrual irregularities in 1957. Mm-hmm. And you won't be surprised to hear that there was a sudden epidemic of menstrual irregularities.
I have them.
And so, you know, there were women for whom it was very difficult to admit to a doctor, especially if they weren't married, that they actually wanted contraception. And it particularly because for young women, there was very much a culture at the time that a nice girl might be swept away by the passion of the moment, but she certainly wasn't supposed to plan to be swept away. And so, you know, being on the birth control pill suggested that you were intending to have sex before marriage, which, you know, that was not what nice girls did. So even among unmarried women, there was real ambivalence about the birth control pill for the first years that it was available at all.
And of course, it was a different pill, much stronger in those days. We're going to talk in this hour with a medical doctor about how she sees the pill then and now, its effectiveness and its health effects. Nancy, remind us where the pill came from. There were women, a couple of very prominent women, pushing for a long, long time to make this a reality. Who were they and why were they so driven to push?
It is fascinating, the characters behind the creation of the pill. The first driving force was Margaret Sanger, who many people know as the founder of Planned Parenthood. She was a woman who was raised by, you know, a devout Catholic mother and a father who carved angels and saints out of marble for a living. And her mother had 18 pregnancies during her lifetime, had 11 children, and died very young. And literally over her mother's grave, Margaret Sanger, you know, accused her father, "You did this to her." You know, it was being pregnant so often that ultimately killed her. And Margaret Sanger went on to train as a nurse, and she worked in the tenements of the Lower East Side of New York. And she saw again and again the enormous toll that it took on women, especially on poor women, to have so little control over their fertility. And so finding what, as early as 1914, she was referring to as a magic pill, really became her life's work. But she would not have been able to achieve that if she didn't come up with the capital to fund that crusade. And pharmaceutical companies or the federal government had no interest in going anywhere near anything as still controversial as contraception. So she had the good fortune to run into a woman named Catherine Dexter McCormick, who was the second woman ever to graduate from MIT. She had a degree in biology. She was born to wealth and married a very wealthy man. And discovered
the farm implement
their marriage.
Company, the McCormick
International Harvester. That's right. And it turned out that he suffered from schizophrenia. And so Catherine McCormick devoted her life not only to trying to find a cure for his illness, but to find a means whereby women who did not want to have children for whatever reason could do so without their husband's cooperation or even knowledge. And so it was Catherine McCormick who put up the vast majority of the money, roughly the equivalent of $15 million in today's money, and Margaret Sanger, who sort of put the team together, who actually came up with the first birth control pill. The other irony is that the leading clinician behind the discovery of the pill, a Harvard-trained doctor named John Rock, was a Catholic physician who devoted his life to helping infertile women try to become pregnant. So his search for a way to help women become pregnant ended up in discovering the means to help them not to.
It's all the same hormones, and then it's just deployed differently. And into that comes wild Mexican yams.
Yes, well, it was I think in the 1930s that chemists first discovered that you could create a synthetic form of progesterone that could help blocking ovulation in women. And it was a scientist named Gregory Pincus who was trying to figure out how to use progesterone in to as a contraceptive. And he was doing all of his experiments on animals. And so it was when he and John Rock collaborated in testing the use of progesterone on women to see whether you could safely block ovulation and therefore have a woman not be able to get pregnant during her cycle. And as you mentioned before, the initial formulation of the birth control pill that they were testing was much stronger. The dosage of hormones was much higher than it would be later. And so the side effects were quite significant. I think the health risks were quite significant. But they did find that they had come up with a formula that was tremendously effective, far more effective than any other form of birth control that had ever been marketed until that point, and that when women stopped taking it, they were still then able to get pregnant if they wanted to afterwards.
Did people stand in awe of this at the time? Did people say, "Oh my gosh, this is going to change everything"?
I would not say that anyone could anticipate, partly because, remember, 1960 was such an interesting sort of flexion point in our history. We had just come through this decade that saw great prosperity, saw great sort of conformity, in which I think a lot of social energies were sort of suppressed and damped down. And it was not until after 1960 and in the decade that followed that you had so many concurrent revolutions occurring in civil rights and in women's rights and in the environment and in medicine and in all of these different arenas of life. I don't think anyone in 1960 had a very clear sense of just what that new frontier, as Kennedy called it, was really going to look like.
400,000 women roughly using the pill in 1961, 1.2 million a year later, triple that by 1965. And today I'm reading something like 100 million women using it around the world. The sexual revolution gets credited here. You say no, but you say the workplace role of women, and we've just got half a minute before the break, Nancy, but the workplace role very much falls in the lineage of the birth control pill.
I think that's very important, Tom. While its impact on sexual behavior, I think, is often overestimated, I think its impact on social and economic behavior is what is so important. As the women's movement broke down the doors to opportunity for women in education and employment, it was the availability of the birth control pill that made it easier for women to go through those doors.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about 50 years of the birth control pill and what it has meant for sex and society. 1960, the FDA gave the green light for the pill to be marketed to American women, and it was in large numbers quickly and much larger, of course, today. Here's part of a commercial that the pharmaceutical company Bayer was running in 2008 for the contraceptive pill Yaz.
All birth control pills are 99% effective and can give you shorter, lighter periods. But there's one pill that goes beyond the rest. It's Yaz, the pill more and more women are turning to. Yaz is the only birth control proven to treat the emotional and physical premenstrual symptoms that are severe enough to impact your life. And it also helps keep skin clear. Yaz contains a different kind
There's the ad, and on goes the pill. You can join the conversation this hour. Do you remember what it meant 40 or 50 years ago? And did the pill set women free in the workplace, the bedroom, marriage, dating? What about men in all this? Nancy Gibbs is with us from Time magazine. She's got a big cover story in Time this week on 50 years of the pill. She joins us from New York. We're joined right now as well from Cleveland, Ohio, by Dr. Elisa Ross. She's an obstetrician, gynecologist, staff physician in the Women's Health Institute of the Cleveland Clinic. Dr. Ross, thank you very much for being here.
Hello, Tom. My pleasure.
So we've got all kinds of questions here. Just some of the web comments that have already come in. Brett says, I don't know what the Catholic Church has to say about the pill now, but when he was a kid, women in his family were told by priests it was a sin. We've got another commenter here. Last week we had a show on women and pay, and this comment is that these topics need to be linked. Without the birth control pill, you know, we might not even be talking about women and what they made in the workplace. And then here's one more saying the main problem with the pill that it's being used by the wrong sex to have real birth control, create an effective pill for men, and you will see birth rates plummet worldwide. A little reaction from the web. Dr. Ross, we just heard that ad from 2008 for a new pill, Yaz. I don't keep up with this so very closely. Has the pill changed a lot in these 50 years?
Well, the pill itself, the medication, has changed quite a bit in terms of dosage and ingredients and the way in which it's administered, the different ratios of the two hormones. Mm-hmm. But what you just heard was the marketing has really changed as well. The non-contraceptive benefits are really being touted now.
Clear skin, irregular periods. The dosage of the active ingredients, progesterone and I don't know what
estrogen,
else.
Estrogen, yes. The original pill had 150 micrograms of an estrogen, and these days it's between 20 and 35.
So that is an enormous difference.
Yeah.
And yet we're in a time when people are much more attuned to what they put in their bodies, where people want the organic life. What do you see as the usage of the pill among I don't know, women in their 20s and 30s today compared to a couple of decades ago. Is it still as widely used, more used? Do you have numbers?
I don't have numbers, but I have an impression from my practice is that young women really like to use the pill as their first means of birth control. Young women today also use condoms. It's not a question of either or, as it was in my day.
We're in the AIDS era. I mean, not that there wasn't sexually transmitted disease then, but once HIV/AIDS came on the scene, that's a different story.
But I think they like the pill so much because it's reversible and it is effective and it's safe. And it has a lot of these nice side effect profiles, which are actually beneficial. Lighter periods, less anemia, fewer headaches. This PMS and acne is a real big seller for the teenage and young 20s crowd.
We've got questions for you. Susan in Manchester, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Susan.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I'm the founding director of a new organization called the National Breast Cancer Prevention Project, or we're also known as nobreastcancer.net, spelled K-N-O-W. And I guess we're really concerned about the recent research that keeps coming in, that keeps showing that women's risk of developing two different kinds of estrogen-negative breast cancers seems to be linked to the use of the current birth control drugs, which certainly have less of the hormones in them, but they still, combined with all of the artificial estrogens, chemical estrogens, xenoestrogens in our cosmetics, our food, growth hormones, etc., that the sense is that adding birth control to the mix is increasing the incidence of HER2-negative breast cancer in women who are over 40 years old. Some doctors, in fact, are not even recommending birth control drugs these days to women over 35.
Susan, let us look at that from the medical professional viewpoint right here. I appreciate your call. Dr. Ross, what do you say? There's the hyper-awareness and concern right there.
Well, I wouldn't say hyper. I think it's appropriate to be concerned about anything that's going in your body. And after all, breast cancer is increasing, and it's out there waiting for all of us. So I think her concern is appropriate. Birth control pills are the most extensively studied medication in the history of medicine. They are studied up one direction and down the other. But she's right in that these newer pills haven't had the time to be followed out far enough. Right now, the World Health Organization does say that there's a small temporary increase in breast cancer in users under 35. But that decreases, the increase of risk decreases after age 35, and by age 55, it's the two groups, ever users and never users, are exactly the same.
Do you take that into account when prescribing or suggesting the pill to your own patients? Is it a factor you discuss, or is it so far at the margins that you don't?
Well, I do have to discuss it, but I put it in terms of actual numbers. I say that a young woman under 35 has a 1 in 1,000 chance of having breast cancer. If she's on the birth control pill, a 2 in 1,000 chance. And one of those two is just background risk. So it is an extra, 999 people who are on the birth control pill at a young age won't have an increase in breast cancer. One might.
Let's get another call from Omaha, Nebraska. Julie. Julie, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I was just thinking about the evolution even personally, in that, when I'm younger, I absolutely didn't want to even consider it, and being Catholic early on, knowing that a lot of those drugs were abortifacients. But as I got older and the periods got more painful and heavier, and, then it became to be able to do the continuous prescription to be able to even prevent the period was even healthier for me, healthier for my marriage, kind of all around. So I would just kind of throw that one out there as well.
A Catholic who wasn't keen on it when you were young, Julie, but has come around to it over the course of time. Nancy Gibbs, what about individually and as society-wide, the sort of evolution of our understanding and attitudes toward the pill?
Well, one thing I would say in the case of Catholic women is that the church's teaching against contraception has to do with the biblical description of marriage as a one flesh union, and that it is an essential part of marriage that the husband and the wife come together with the intention of having children. And so contraception, which is an intention to not have children, is what is against church teaching. But for a patient like this who might want to, and there were many Catholic women in this position, who might want to take the birth control pill not for birth control reasons, but for some other condition, like for painful or irregular periods. As I understand it, under church teaching, as long as it is not, if their main intention is not contraception, but they need it for other medical reasons, that is acceptable. So there was a time when there was a belief within the Catholic Church and among many lay people that there might be an adjustment in church teaching and that this would be something that would be left up to an individual couple's conscience. There was some real confusion through the 1950s and into the early 1960s about whether the Catholic Church might follow the Anglican Church and other Protestant churches in changing their teaching on birth control. And it was in 1968 when the Pope reaffirmed the teaching against contraception, that that was sort of settled for the Church, and that teaching against it remains in place.
Those teachings aside, millions of women picked it up, and millions of women ended up in the workplace. Now, you're not so keen on linking the sexual revolution directly with the pill. We'll talk more about that. But what about women's role in working America?
Well, one of the things that women would hear in the 1960s, and remember, you know, back in 1960, still a third of women were in the workforce, and that number was growing already. But one thing that women ran into was an attitude among employers about either not hiring or not promoting them out of the fear, well, you'll just get pregnant and have to drop out, and so whatever money we've invested in training you will go to waste. Mm-hmm. And so what happened with the acceptance and dissemination of the birth control pill was it made it much harder for employers or for colleges and universities, especially after the passage of Title IX, to discriminate against women on the grounds that they were a risky investment and that their educational progress or their employment progress might end up suddenly taking a detour because of an unintended pregnancy. And so that the ability for women to organize and plan their lives and sequence their choices in a different way of saying, I'm going to spend so many years in school or in graduate school or as a sort of apprentice in my workplace before I start to try to start a family, became much more possible with the birth control pill. And you had many fewer marriages that were sort of a shotgun marriage that was forced mm-hmm. upon perhaps an unready couple by an unintended pregnancy.
Birth control giving a much bigger sense of control. Let's go to Leighton in Charleston, South Carolina. Leighton, you're on the air. What do you know, Leighton?
Here's what I know. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I graduated from medical school 50 years ago exactly, and I had one woman in my class of 80.
Wow.
I returned to the university 30 years later in 1990 to be the dean of a medical school.
Mm-hmm.
And we had almost achieved 50%. And we have achieved that nationwide now. And I believe that the birth control pill was a crucial spark plug to culture change and psychological change that facilitated women coming into medicine. So in one sense, we were able in this nation to open up double the number of potential applicants
from
medical school.
From one in 80 to 50%, you'd have to call that a real earth-moving change, Leighton.
Without a doubt, it was an earth-moving change.
That's not only a bigger pool to draw from, but that's a whole universe of gender, perceptivity brought into the medical profession.
There's no question. I've stated publicly, occasionally to the dismay of some of my colleagues, that women are born healers and men have to be educated to be so. So I think it's been marvelous for medicine.
Leighton, thank you very much for your call. Nancy Gibbs, there's the point made that a tiny pill, but gigantic effects, and that's just in the medical profession.
But you saw this across the board, Tom. It mm-hmm. even just between 1970 and 1980, you had the numbers of women attending business school go from something like 4% to 36%. In law school, it went up again 5-10-fold. You had the typical age of first marriage jump by 2.5 years within just a single decade. You had really significant sort of statistical changes happening very quickly after 1970, where you had the combination of the social changes that were telling women it was okay for you to broaden your horizons much beyond home and family, and the medical technology in the form of the birth control pill that made that more possible.
Let's go to Niagara Falls, New York, and Mark. Hi, Mark, you're on the air.
Hi. I may be all wet, but it seemed to me like there's quite a bit of overlap between penicillin coming on the market in a big way and the birth control pill. And I think that together they made both sexes somewhat more reckless about what used to be called venereal disease. I guess they're not called that anymore.
But, mm-hmm.
And also, this occurred to me after I talked to your screener, but they used to, when the prophylactics condoms came on the market, they weren't allowed to be sold in many states as birth control. They were prophylactic to prevent the spread of disease.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll listen to whatever you may have to say about it off the air.
Thank you, Mark. Let us hold that thought right there for a moment. And, of course, penicillin preceding it, but it did come in, to that same world. Let's get another call from Stanton, Virginia. Ken, you're on the air. Hello, Ken.
Hello.
Hello, Ken, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I was living in London during the 60s, and I noticed an enormous difference in the way women behaved as the pill became more prevalent. They become bolder. They were prepared to make the first move. They would call you on the phone. To think that it didn't have much effect on a sexual revolution seems amazing to me. I just didn't see it that way.
Not buying. In fact, you saw it the other way. Eliza Ross, I don't know exactly how old you are and how far back your memory and awareness go, but what about sexuality and the pill and how it played out, you know, with marrieds, with unmarrieds, with frequency of sexual activity? What do you know?
Well, I'm 52, so I kind of missed that little part, but mm-hmm. I read about it in magazines, you know, as a 10-year-old, so
right.
And dreamed of the day I could go to London, too.
Yeah, right. Swings like a pendulum clock.
We do see that there's a certain amount of sexual freedom with being on the pill, to not have to worry month after month, am I going to get my period? Am I
right.
pregnant? That's a huge amount of freedom right there within a relationship, or even could encourage people to move between relationships.
And Nancy, I mean, your own magazine, 1964, you remind us, quoting Time, declaring the second sexual revolution, the pursuit of pleasure, overtaking the pursuit of happiness. I mean, the pill, it may have just been contemporary? Contemporaneous,
but
Ken saying, come on, it was freedom.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I am by no means suggesting that the sexual revolution did not happen. And in fact, it was well underway even in the supposedly staid and buttoned down 1950s, which is, you know, when Hugh Hefner created Playboy and when you had, you know, the beginning of the growth of a very different attitude toward sexuality, toward sexual license. This had been brewing, I think, for quite some time and really was unleashed in the 1960s. And there, we did see significant changes in sexual behavior at that time. And it was very easy to say, well, it must all be because of the pill, because the pill also arrived at that time. All I'm suggesting is that there is no data that can prove that it was the pill that caused it. And of course, partly this is because what studies were done about women's contraceptive use were done, again, of married women.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is not that single women were not behaving differently or did not have different attitudes towards sexuality, but suggesting that it was because of the arrival of the pill, I think, is a risky leap of logic to make, because again, the pill was not widely available for single women until some years later. But certainly there were so many forces that came together in the 1960s that had the effect of liberalizing the culture and the message in the culture regarding sexuality that we saw a very dramatic change at that time.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about 50 years of the birth control pill and what it's meant for Sex and Our Society. Nancy Gibbs is with us, editor-at-large for Time Magazine. Big cover story on 50 years of the pill there. Dr. Elisa Ross is with us from Cleveland, Ohio, obstetrician and gynecologist, staff physician in the Women's Health Institute of the Cleveland Clinic. Let's get a call from Megan in Whitman, Massachusetts. Hi, Megan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm just curious if they think that the pill has had an impact for fertility issues, that women suppressing their fertility for so long has contributed to the infertility issues you hear about so much.
Of women a little bit later in their fertile years, maybe in their late 20s or 30s, you mean, Megan?
I know age, you know, contributes to you infertility, obviously, but I just didn't know if suppressing it for so long.
Yeah,
kind of.
It's an interesting question. Thanks, Megan. Dr. Ross, what do you say?
Yes, that is one of the commonly asked questions about the birth control pill, and we're labeling that idea that pills could cause infertility as one of the common myths. We think that birth control pills do not contribute to infertility. What happens is, while someone's on the pill, they're having regular periods, but they're not really periods. They're withdrawal bleeding from the hormones that they're taking. And sometimes people find that through the passage of time, after they're on the pill, after they're off the pill, their periods become irregular and their ovulations have become less frequent, but they didn't notice it because they were on the pill.
But you don't see an increase in infertility among women who have taken the pill for some years?
We only see that in people who were previously had irregular periods and went on the pill because of irregular periods. Then later on, when they're off again, they've got irregular periods again. Fertility usually returns within 2 weeks, and the hormones are out of your system within 2 days.
That's a powerful and quick return. And I guess, as you say, a very frequently asked question, understandably so. Let me go to Ruth in Canton, Connecticut. Ruth, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah. I have a quick question. I have a friend who did his dissertation on the effect of synthetic hormones on aquatic creatures, and the greatest concentration of that came from hormonal birth control. And I think that 50 years really in history and in light of our bodies and how amazing they've developed is really just a brief period, a brief window of time. And we might find in 25 years that we've really done damage to our environment through these synthetic hormones as well as to our bodies. And I'll take your response off the air.
Yes, thank you, Ruth. Dr. Ross, I'll come again to you. I know you're not an environmentalist, but, you know, we do hear about the drugs being passed from humans into the environment, three-eyed fish and all the rest. Do you see a connection with the birth control hormones in particular?
Well, I was smiling as she was saying that because, wow, that's such a concept. It is true that hormones are urinated out, the extra ones that aren't utilized and that aren't metabolized, and they could find their way to the ocean, I would guess, yeah.
And not only the ocean, but lake and stream. And, Nancy, this is bigger than the birth control pill, but it's certainly something that people have become hyper aware of. I mean, I'm struck in so many ways in these 50 years, from 1960 to now. I know Rachel Carson and Silent Spring was back there, but now the concern among everybody is much more nuanced and attuned than it was in 1960 about environmental impacts.
Oh, I think, you know, we are all now getting a crash course in the environmentally responsible ways to dispose of excess or outdated pharmaceuticals in our households and ways in which we should be more aware than we are about just, you know, dumping drugs into either the water supply or into landfills where potentially they become an environmental problem. I think, you know, it's obviously this has gone on for years and years, and yet it's only more recently, I think, that people are conscious that this is something to be concerned about.
Environmental questions and more intimate ones perhaps for humans. Margaret in Suffield, Connecticut. You're on the air, Margaret.
Hello?
Hi, Margaret. You're on.
Okay. My question was, with all the research that they have done about the pill, have they noticed that the incidence of autism has gone up within the 50 years that the pill came to be? Or has there been no connection between the pill and autism?
Let us look at it. Thanks, Margaret. Dr. Ross?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any studies that look at the linkage. There's so many other things that are going on in our world right now, but I think they probably should look at it.
That will leave a question mark in some minds, but I don't know what to do about it. It's good.
Oh, no. I mean, there's no, I don't know of any studies that, mm-hmm. that have connected those things at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Dubuque, Iowa. Janet, you're on the air, Janet.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm 72 years old and mm-hmm. can remember like yesterday as a Catholic with a six-month-old baby and unexpectedly pregnant with another,
yep.
even though nursing,
yep.
Being devastated when the Vatican came out against the pill. I sobbed for a half an hour or more and was sure I was going to have a dozen kids, and I yep. did not want to have a dozen kids.
How did you resolve this, Janet?
Fortunately, I had just the two girls, and I don't know what happened, but we ended up with just the two.
Did you take Vatican sort of guidance here and avoid using the birth control pill?
We avoided using the birth control pill, yes.
And when you look back, do you wish you could have? Do you wish it had been different somehow?
I wished I could have used the birth control pill to control things a little better. Two kids in 14 months... is a challenge,
mm-hmm.
and so I was devastated thinking I was going to have 6, 10, 12 kids.
Time magazine, in Nancy's edition this week, is running these photographs. You know, it looks like kind of a xylophone of, I don't know, 10 kids, and they look like, you know, sort of 10 months or 12 months apart. So it's not as though that didn't happen. I mean, Nancy, this came into such a fraught environment. It wasn't just... here's a new convenience, everybody will use it. There was a lot of trepidation, not just among Catholics, but there was a lot of sort of moral slicing and dicing of what this new medicine meant.
Well, you know, in the early years after its approval in 1960, the pill supporters made often a very different argument. Their argument did not refer to women's freedom and opportunity and control over their bodies and fertility. The argument you heard very commonly was that this was going to be a useful weapon in the war against communism.
Because...
And the way that went was the warning that there was a population explosion coming, and that particularly in developing countries, if you had uncontrolled growth of population, it would lead to famine and social instability and political instability. And this would make these countries ripe for communist takeover. And so you had a big push for contraception that came for sort of geopolitical reasons, that this would help create more stable countries around the world by avoiding what was called the population bomb.
Dr. Ross, does anybody use the pill alone these days? Well, of course, it depends on your circumstances. I guess in a monogamous relationship that's really monogamous, you won't have ideally the threat of sexually transmitted disease. But there's a lot out there. I mean, as soon as the 80s came. I would think if you looked at the numbers, condoms must have come back in a big way on top of use of the pill.
Yes, that's for sure true. And one of the things about the pill's advent is that it took the idea of contraception away from the moment of having sex. You know, in the olden days, if you had a condom on or a diaphragm in, you'd know it. And then the pill came along and you didn't know if there was any protection. But now we have two different conversations, one for contraception and one for sexually transmitted disease protection.
So, Nancy, there was that kind of, depending how you look at it, that sort of golden age where you had the pill, people had to be careful, but it was a far different scene from what suddenly emerged in the 1980s.
Yes, that's very true, and I think that's one reason why attitudes and use of the pill, it has tended to evolve from decade to decade. And certainly after the 1980s and with the concern about HIV/AIDS, the pill still had its hold as a valuable contraceptive device, but it was not sufficient. It gave you no protection against sexually transmitted diseases.
Well, that was something for a while, though. Lansing, Michigan. Harriet, you're on the air, Harriet.
Well, a wonderful show as always.
Thanks, Harriet.
I wanted to say that I met my husband freshly out of high school and freshman week on campus mm-hmm. at the University of Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And I came from a family that was taught, very religious family, and taught not to be promiscuous at all.
Mm-hmm.
My husband and I dated for 3 years and decided we were going to get married the summer between our senior year on campus. And so we went to the doctor, I did, to have my wedding examination back in those days, and
right.
I asked about birth control pills. because I had heard about them and thought that would be a great way to go. We didn't have any money. I had a job. My husband was a full-time student. I was part-time.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor told me that he was not able to talk to me regarding birth control pills because he was Catholic. So my husband and I, at that time my fiancé and I, thought we were pretty smart and we would know how to handle things.
Yeah.
But I tell you, I got pregnant on the honeymoon.
Wow.
And my husband's parents weren't too happy about it because they didn't want us to get married until school was over with.
Right.
But, in those days, the doctor couldn't even talk to you about birth control pills if he was Catholic.
Harriet, do you think your life, your working life, might have been different if you had been able to, felt free to avail yourself of the pill in those days?
I do. I do. I had my young son and was able to stay home and take care of him, which I also believe in that. And both my children I've been able to work with and stay home and be a home mother and have totally enjoyed that phase of my life. And I've done a lot of different work over the years, but I honestly feel that raising my two sons has been the best reward ever. I have a close relationship with them that I would never have if I had been a working mother. But I do feel my life would have taken a different pattern.
Well, it's a beautiful thing, but it's also a very, very instructive story, and I appreciate your sharing it with us, Harriet. Nancy Gibbs, there it is in a nutshell, pregnant on the honeymoon, and that was the end of her working life. She found great satisfaction in being a mother. But those sort of career choices that were available to an awful lot of other women later, the door of biology sort of slammed on them for Harriet.
And, you know, let me point out that Harriet's story is not sort of, you know, a relic of an older time. We are still debating in many places arguments over conscience clauses and the right of either doctors or pharmacists to refuse to prescribe the pill if it is against their personal conscience. And so this is an ongoing debate about the access, the right of women to have access to birth control versus the right of an individual doctor or pharmacist to follow their own conscience and not prescribe it.
Not to mention the ongoing debate about work and motherhood and, you know, the relative weight and place of each. Let's get a caller maybe on that front. Dinka in Danbury, Connecticut. Dinka, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. That's one thing that I wanted to bring up. Actually, I kind of find it a little bit depressing to think that the pill was this big feminist thing, but actually, you know, it was required of a woman, or what's supposed to liberate her was for her to chemically alter her healthy body on a, you know, permanent, semi-permanent basis in order to fit in into what the workplace was requiring. And I think this is still sort of a problem that's going on because The woman is not the problem. The attitude is the problem that, you know, oh, the woman is so complicated. Well, with her pregnancies, the children, it's always just such a burden.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like unless, you know, we create an environment where this is acceptable and normal and children are welcome in the sense that we all carry responsibility for it, not just, you know, the women with their pesky conditions of always getting pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of feel, you know, well, it's true. I feel this because, you know, I'm a stay-at-home mother and I did this on purpose and I, you know, it was my choice.
Yep.
But still, I mean, there are many days where I wish, you know, my husband and I wouldn't have to split it like this. You know, he's always gone. I am always here. You know, I could use maybe a break or something else to do, and he could use more time with his children, but the society doesn't work this way. And I feel this is, we're still carrying this. And I honestly, I mean, I don't take the pill and I just don't, I miss this conversation about why is it so liberating for a woman to always put something in her body, to alter something that is perfectly fine, just so we can all have, you know, whatever everybody else wants.
Yeah, Dinka, I love the distinctiveness of your perspective, and we'll pick it up. I mean, Nancy, you know, Dinka's right in a way. The pill made women sort of, you know, very high utility widgets for the economy, right? It made them able to sort of fit right in without accommodating biology. Dinka's saying, would it not have been better still if somehow the economy would have accommodated women more effectively?
Well, you know, we at Time did a big survey this fall in conjunction with the Rockefeller Foundation having to do with both men and women's attitudes to some of these work-life balance questions.
Mm-hmm.
And the overwhelming majority, again, of both men and women, there was very little difference between them, was the thing that they most wanted was for the government and employers to make this balance easier, that it shouldn't come down to, you know, choosing not to have children, that it ought to be possible to have, you know, better child care options, more flexible work days, a more accommodating attitude in the economy and in from employers, so that this juggling act is not so difficult. I think what Dinka was expressing is one that is a view that's shared by a great many people, and it came up in our surveys. It came up again and again and again.
Dr. Ross, let me ask you about what we had a web comment, and you hear many over the years talking about it. Where's the pill for men? I think I saw a flurry of headlines, I don't know, a year ago or so. Will there come a day when the responsibility for birth control shifts from female to male? I mean, it could, I suppose, hypothetically already. But at the level of a pill, what about it?
I sure hope so, but I haven't heard of any promising leads.
The male biology just isn't amenable somehow?
Yeah, they use the same hormone for sexual response as they use for fertility. And so to try and separate those, I think, is what the hang-up is for them.
So for the foreseeable future, if it's going to be a pill, it's going to be the women's pill.
I think so.
Wow. Well, 50 years and a lot of change in that time. Sort of change is hard to take fully on board in just an hour, but you've each helped us do that wonderfully here, and we're grateful to you. Dr. Elisa Ross at the Cleveland Clinic, the Women's Health Institute there. Dr. Ross, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And Nancy Gibbs, editor-at-large at Time Magazine, it is always wonderful to have you with us. Can't miss your big cover story, The Pill, in great big letters, and you've brought it to life for us wonderfully. Thank you, Nancy, very much for being here today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.